Snitches get stitches. That's an old refrain, a very old refrain it seems, one that seemed to have been prevalent in London about 700 years ago. The great robbery of the Royal Treasury of 1303 is an amazing crime, but one that was solved remarkably quickly, it seems. Within days of the royal authorities beginning their investigations, the culprits had been found. A bunch of corrupt monks living in Westminster Abbey had been seized and arrested and taken to the Tower of London, along with a couple of Confederates based in London itself. And yet, the investigation was still ongoing. The King's hunters wanted more. They had ascertained that between the robbery and their investigation starting, about a month had passed. A month during which no one had told the King. And sure, maybe no one was supposed to have known of the theft, but there seems to have been dozens of people involved. And worse than that, it wasn't that the King's treasure had gone missing. It was more that after pulling off this audacious robbery in Westminster, the gang had fenced their goods. They had sold the valuables of the King, and they had seemingly sold them in London. And this made London nervous. So far, the city had been aiding the authorities in the investigation, with the mayor acting as a bait for the royal justices to go lure out men to confess. But now the investigation was only really beginning, and they were asking some very awkward questions. Had London's leading aldermen and merchants been accessories after the fact? How deep did the corruption go? And it begs a question from me. If London was involved in this robbery, how far would the authorities go to cover up their tracks? Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city as a single long narrative tale. We have just reached the second part of the story of this robbery, the Westminster job, wherein we will examine the events of just a few months, where the royal agents discovered just how bent London was as a city, and where the biggest crime ever committed in London's history, yeah, everyone knew about it, but no one said a goddamn thing. Welcome then to chapter 110 of the story of London, part 2 of the Westminster job, the Great London Cover-Up. At its heart, the Great Robbery of 1303 was simply the single most successful physical robbery that has ever happened in the city. Last episode, I tried to explain it like one of those true crime podcasts, but this time I'm going to treat it like a history podcast. So what did happen? What had caused all of this? And to this, I turn to the conclusions of the historian P.C. Doherty, whose detailed and highly entertaining book on this robbery has been the principal source of this episode and also the previous episode, and I'll talk about that more towards the end. The origin of this crime lied in the character of the Abbot of Westminster, Walter Wenlock. This petty, greedy, and corrupt man acted in a way that was unbecoming of his status and role. But casual nepotism was not something you'd lose your job over. Nor was keeping a mistress nearby, even if you were an abbot. But keeping a mistress nearby, fathering a daughter by her, and then using abbey funds to fund them both while keeping everyone quiet about it, yeah, that would have ruined him. And as such, he was now prone to blackmail by the man who knew this dark secret, a man called Alexander de Pershore, who held the position of sub-prior of Westminster Abbey, but who was actually now the real power there, browbeating and dominating the prior, and basically being given free rein to run the abbey as he so wished, as long as he kept Abbot Wenlock's dark secret a secret. Alexander de Pershore comes across as a ruthless, unscrupulous man, not above threats and viciousness. It is significant that in all the investigations that took place around the robbery, the one man who threatened to arrange to kill any of his co-conspirators if they revealed what was going on was Alexander de Pershaw. Call him the godfather of this entire operation. Pershaw's blackmail of the abbot, followed by his intimidation of the prior, meant that this sub-prior basically took over the entire abbey, and it allowed him and a small cabal of monks who supported him basically live like kings. It had transformed the rule of Abbot Wenlock from a strict draconian Benedictine order into one where the sub-prior simply enjoyed his domain. It was Pershaw's effective reign of indolence and graft that started the circumstances that led to the great robbery to happen. Pershaw was a man who loved the ladies and good food, and such a lifestyle demanded a constant supply of silver. And him and his corrupt monks quickly discovered that taking from abbey funds was not enough to maintain this lifestyle. They needed other people's treasures. And so the abbey had become a robber's den, with a small body of monks always looking for ways to grab other folks' money. And in this, the presence of the actual royal treasury located directly below them, it was a hell of a temptation. And this ties into the fact that there was a spate of attempts at robbing the treasury. In 1296, a man called John the Cook was implicated in an attempt to rob the treasury. It, of course, failed. We have to mention, however, that Eldelina, the daughter of Nicholas the Cook, was also involved in the 1303 attempt. And there was a strong possibility that there was a link between Pershaw's corrupt monks, the Cook family, and attempts to rob the royal treasury. There was another attempt in 1300, and the monks were definitely involved, but this also failed. This attempt was spotted, and Pershaw got Abbot Wenlock to square things with the king. He gave the king a load of cash at the audacity, said it was a one-off, wouldn't happen again, and the king would be assured that his vault was secure and impregnable. But they were not just robbing the treasury at the time. The good brothers had more success in stealing hundreds of pounds worth of silver that had been sent to the abbey, intended to be used in the ceremonies around the Requiem Masses sung for the king's late wife. Wenlock again had no choice but to hush these matters up and buy off the king. Alexander de Pershaw and his confederates simply waited. By the early 1300s, Edward had become an absent ruler, campaigning in Scotland. The Palace of Westminster had become deserted. Its keeper, John de Cenci, had left everything to his deputy, William Palmer. And William Palmer started hanging around with Alexander de Pershaw. During this time, the monks had all the time in the world to study the outside of the crypt, to search for weaknesses, to search for a way in, to come up with many schemes. Alexander Palmer was not just the keeper of the Royal Palace of Westminster, he was the keeper of Fleet Prison. He knew several prisoners and their confederates, the seedy underworld of London. He dined with them, he became friends with them, and he introduced them to his new friends. And that meant the monks over in Westminster Abbey got to know both the underworlds of London and Westminster. And they drew in the likes of John the Rishi, a criminal from Bedfordshire who got a job as a servant in the abbey. And other criminals became members of their growing social circle. John of Rippenhale, the defrocked priest and specialist church robber, and another criminal called John de Ugly. The monks attracted such twilight figures as they planned this great robbery. The treasure was just there. How would they get it? Of course, getting hold of the treasure was only half the battle. Robbing a great royal treasure was actually the easy part of it. Fencing it. Now that was the difficult part. By the summer of 1302, the monks still needed what we would basically call a middleman who, after the robbery, would break up the treasure and sell it in the London markets. And enter at this point into the tale a man called Richard de Pudlingcott. Originally from Oxford, a self-proclaimed merchant from a family who had close connections with the Benedictine Order of Monks. Now, from the investigations after the fact, we know that witnesses described Pudlingcott as a very close friend of one of the monks of the abbey, but they don't know who exactly, but it was probably Alexander de Pershaw. How they became friends is a bit convoluted, but it appears Pudlingcott was a relative of a local man called John de Lenton. John de Lenton was based in Westminster, and he and his wife owned land in the nearby Longditch, and he was related to Pudlingcott and made the introduction. So when Pudlingcott arrived in London, he was not some lonely merchant, he describes himself in later testimony, but was somebody who had a way in and became friends and got to know people, and friendships were forged, alliances were entered into, and plans were laid. The gang had by now worked out that the best mean of access to the treasury was a single low window. And so the ground around the crypt windows were deliberately sown with hemp seeds. Hemp was a common crop in medieval England, sown in late spring, and was very fast growing. This would be a plant that could grow up all over the abbey grounds that nobody would question and could be easily explained away. But more importantly, it could be used to hide their handiwork off their robbery and to provide cover as they go through the window they wanted to choose. Everything started to fall into place. But there was still one major problem. The monks and Pudlingcott needed to finance this operation. There would be other monks they needed to bribe to look the other way. City officials needed to be bribed to not ask questions. They needed working cash to properly set this major robbery into action. And where would they get that cash from? Well, they raided very close to home. The precious plates and silverware off Westminster's Abbey refectory itself was burgled. Now, this was not burgled with someone in a mask shimming through the window. No, Pudlingcott and Lenton were given the keys to the refectory by the corrupt monks. They just let themselves in. The raid took place sometime between November and December 1302. The doors and the gates of the abbey were unlocked for them, and they just entered and helped themselves. Baskets of jewelled cups and plates were removed through the abbey grounds and into the grounds of Westminster Palace, where they could have only have got there because of the help from William of the Palace, and then down across the quayside to the King's Steps themselves, down to the river. The plunder was then bundled aboard a boat, heaped in sacks, and some of it fell overboard. And a local fisherman caught some of these precious items in his nets just before Christmas of 1302. But these items were taken and sold. And we have no idea who to. But it's probable that a small network of London goldsmiths were simply willing to not ask where the goods come from, and the gang was able to make a fortune quietly selling on the items. Ta-da! The final piece of the network was in place. The robbers now knew they could move any item stolen from the treasury if need be, with respectable London merchants more than willing to ask no questions and pay in cash. Pudlingcott used some of his plunder to finance his new lifestyle, but most of it was probably used to bribe other city officials and to buy his way into London's richer communities. It was the key to introducing Pudlingcott to city merchants and goldsmiths. In doing so, Pudlingcott actually became a well-known figure on the London scene. People knew where he lived, in a house down in Dowgate, and they also knew his friends, John the Lenton, a man called James Horner, and finally, a man called Robert Barber, who lived in Candlewick Street. Barber, crucially, was probably a relative of two sisters who had links to the criminal underworld found around Fleet Prison, women called Alice and Castanea Barber. The Barber sisters seem to have been quite formidable women, who basically organised a gang of criminals around them. Pudlingcott gathered this group up along with new specialists needed for the actual robbery, such as John the Mason of St Albans and Philip the Carpenter, men brought in for their technical expertise. So, you had a body of monks who were the masterminds behind this, but could not do the crime, as, you know, monks with odd haircuts and black and white robes would be noticed wandering around the city doing stuff. So they, under their godfather, Alexander de Penshaw, had begun finding similar criminal folks to help them. The corrupt royal official, William of the Palace, had certainly helped and had allowed the refractory robbery take place using the palace grounds to get the goods out of Westminster. And Richard Pudlingcott had now gathered up not just a gang of crooks led by the Barber sisters to help physically move the items from the treasury, but he had also established a working network of goldsmiths and officials in nearby London to handle and dispose of any stolen goods. The final remaining problem was making sure they had undisturbed access to the abbey and the nearby grounds of the palace. William Palmer would cover the palace part, but the Abbey security was taken care of by the judicious appointment in early 1303, probably at Alexander de Pershore's behest, of his fellow corrupt-as-hell monk, Adam de Warfield, as sacristan of Westminster. The sacristan was in charge of security in the Abbey. He was now the ultimate inside man. The sown hemp sprouted tall and thick, the technical help was available, the people were in place, and by the end of April 1303, Pudlingcott and his company were ready. The first signs the robbery was taking place is when the Barber sisters, accompanied by John de Ugly, William and John Kinbuston and a few others, gathered with William of the Palace in the vicinity of the Fleet Prison on the Tuesday before Friday the 3rd of May 1303. Over the next few days, they were seen following a strange routine, feasting and revelling in taverns around Fleet Prison before riding off down Fleet Street towards Westminster Abbey. They did this over the next few nights, arriving at the Abbey, whose gates were closed and sealed and guarded by local men like Gilbert de Waite, who would open them just for the gang. They would disappear into the Abbey grounds and would return back to London just before dawn. This ties in with confessions given later by John de Rippendale and Richard de Pudlingcott. The robbery itself was spread over 3 days, taking place between Tuesday the 30th of April and Friday the 3rd of May that year, when the palace, abbey and surrounding grounds were put off limits by the large gang. They went in through one of the windows. John the Mason attacked the sill onto the sixth window, removing it, and was able to prise the bars out of the brickwork above it. This would have taken hours of work and been noisy, hence the security measures around the abbey and the palace. Crucially, the window in question was not only the sole way through, literally metres of hard stone, it was also the one method of entry which could be covered up afterwards. A hole in the wall is impossible to hide, but a forced sill and removed bars could be loosely repositioned, so only close scrutiny would reveal something untoward had happened, an unlikely occurrence in such a desolate, hemp-infested part of the Abbey grounds. You see, Pudlingcott and his gang needed time. The robbery would eventually be detected, but the longer this took, the better. Once the sill and bars had been loosened and the shutters beyond removed, Pudlingcott went through the window down into the treasury proper, details of which he'd actually probably learned about from a member of John Le Conver's household. If you remember last episode, I said John de Le Conver's had been the mason who'd been responsible for building that crypt and perhaps even carving out the secret recesses in the central pillars. It should be noted that afterwards a trusted servant of Conver's later fell under suspicion for having received stolen items. Yeah, Pudlingcott had done his homework. Once in the crypt, Pudlingcott could help himself, opening chests and coffers, breaking up precious goods and passing them out to the rest of the team, the Barber sisters and their companions from Fleet Prison. The robbery took place over successive nights, so lamps and candles and torches would need to be lit. Locks had to be prized open, bricks in the central pillar forced loose. The windows in the crypt are long and narrow, and rope ladders would have been needed to be used and a system established to pass the goods out. I mean, gold, silver and precious stones actually weigh a lot. Many items had to be broken up before they could be taken away after nightfall. They were loaded into sacks and baskets and placed on the monk's cart, which witnesses and juries mention were seen going backwards and forwards between the abbey and the royal enclosure. And like that, they robbed the place blind. The spoils were divided into three. Pudlingcott got one third, William of the Palace got a second third, and the monks in the abbey got the final third. Any other criminals who had been brought into the enterprise would get their share from those thirds. Because of that, individuals also helped themselves, and in their drunken hurry, it's no surprise that precious items fell out and were found in the abbey grounds, or individual criminals hid their part of the plunder around the church and palace. Pudlingcott apparently chose the smaller items, coins, jewels and broken up silver and gold plate, for his goldsmith colleagues. Larger items, such as the Cross of Neath or the unicorn horn, which was used for ceremonial anointing, was given to William of the Palace. And idiot that he was, he simply hid them under his bed. Items were also given to the monks in the abbey, and they kept some and employed servants to move the rest about until it could be fenced. In the end, Puddlingcott and his accomplices considered themselves safe, at least for a while. The plunder, the contents of the treasury had been removed, the window resealed, the king was hundreds of miles away to the north, whilst the monks sat back, protected as their status as monks and therefore beyond secular law. The entire gang thought they had enough time to move into the next stage of their operation, the sale and distribution of their ill-gotten gains. Here, however, they made one mistake. Not all of the monks of Westminster Abbey would keep silent or were in on this indolent criminal lifestyle. Some of the monks must have notified the authorities. Edward I's letter of the 6th of June specifically mentions, quote, "We accepted the testimony of faithful and worthy men," unquote. Now, the king keeps his source anonymous, but he doesn't talk of royal or city officials, but men who by their very status are to be believed. It sounds like the monks. So now the king knew, and this revealed the robbers' second mistake. They simply underestimated the old king. In his youth, Edward I had been called the Leopard, partly because of his ferocity, partly because of his courage, but also partly because of his speed. The king retaliated swiftly, ordering Drakensvold and the other justices into London. They arrived by the middle of June, and some of the robbers panicked. You'll notice during the investigations, they focused on the actions of a hapless man called Gerin, the linen draper of St. Giles. He'd been employed by the monks of the abbey as a messenger, and during this crisis, they used him again to move treasure from the abbey into the fields around St. Pancras to hide it. But that was spotted. The crown intervened long before the robbers had expected. Adam de Warfield, the sacristan, on the 11th of June was also moving stolen goods around, while others were busy transporting items into fields and ditches between the abbey and the royal mews. Naturally, such activity became common knowledge and was witnessed by people in neighbourhoods, and would all come out in the wash. Drakensvold increased the pressure by demanding a proclamation be issued, declaring that anyone who knew anything about the robbery must present themselves at the Guild Hall. I covered this last episode. This proclamation was issued on the 16th of June, and the robbers made their truly fatal mistake, because it is clear they had placed too much confidence in William of the Palace, who, according to later testimony, was already openly boasting about his involvement in the plundering of the royal treasury. William must have realised that eventually someone would say something to the authorities, so hoped to turn king's evidence. He names the monks, naming them thinking they're going to be protected because they're clerics and not under secular law, and then he can say that and says he only just heard about this robbery and he didn't mention it because somebody gave him 10 shillings and he hoped this testimony would place him beyond suspicion. As I said last episode, the names he gave allowed Drakensvold to swoop on the abbey and, with the help of monks who hated what had happened, discovered the names of the principal malefactors. As I described, they kicked open doors and found actual evidence of the monks' involvement. Stolen property on them. The criminal monks seemed to have squealed at the threat of being summarily killed or beaten up, and they gave Drakensvold some additional names. Further house raids were organised. The authorities caught Puddlingcott with some stolen jewels, caught red-handed. John the Mason was caught with his stone-breaking tools. John de Lenton was discovered with the key to the abbey refectory. John de Rippendale with his mallet and chisel. And John de Newmarket with some of the stolen plunder as well. They received no warning and were caught fast. The arrogance the monks were displaying was understandable. They were clerics on holy soil, guardians of the Royal Chapel of Westminster, beyond the Bar of London, or any type of secular authority. But for Puddlingcott to have any arrogance, on the other hand, was strange. He was a foreigner in London, a man with no reputation, who was trading where he had no right, selling precious plate at the time when this was scarce. I mean, rumours had already been circulating about treasure being found in Westminster and of the monks throwing out the local coroner. Puddlingcott should have been terrified when he was caught. And yet, from all accounts, he comes across as assured. He displays a cool demeanour in all the legal proceedings that followed. This must have sprung from not that he felt the monks could protect him, but from the idea that Maybe he felt someone in the city would protect him. He'd spent a lot of money buying that. Puddlingcott had, by his own admission, been in London since early April 1302, yet the authorities of London had done nothing, despite silver, gold and precious jewels being found in fields and ditches, not to mention its appearance on the precious metal markets of London and in Northampton and in Colchester. More than that, William Palmer of the Palace and others of the gang like De Ricci had not been above boasting that they had robbed the royal treasury, while John the Mason, Rippendale and Larishi were not shy about suddenly showing off a marked difference in their standard of living. Puddlingcott had been seen around London, negotiating with this merchant and that, but nothing was done until the arrival of the royal commissioners. When suddenly, a sheriff of London called Hugh Port, or Hugh Porty, suddenly becomes involved in this story. I mean, the royal investigators' suspicion of London must have hardened after the arrest of Puddlingcott. They saw him not lodged, as was the king's orders, quote, in our prison safely and securely, unquote, but in the house of the man who arrested him, Hugh Port. And then 5 days after he was arrested, he escaped to take sanctuary in the Church of St. Michael's in Candlewick. On balance of probability, as well as all available evidence, there can be no doubt that Puddlingcott hoped the city fathers would protect him after this crime, and one city father in particular, Sheriff Hugh Port. So why this Sheriff of London? Hugh Port belonged to one of the oldest families of the city, a fishmonger, an alderman of various wards who invested in loans and the export of wool. Port's involvement, or lack of it, in any attempt to detain Puddlingcott is actually quite mysterious. Puddlingcott had been around London, and especially after the robbery of the Abbey Refectory, before Christmas 1302, and had been seen and known to be going around selling expensive items. Expensive items had been fished out of the Thames. New gold and jewels are suddenly being sold on the market. Nothing was done. Puddlingcott robbed the royal treasury at the beginning of May 1303, yet between that date and the 16th of June, only 6 weeks in all, this foreigner from Oxford had simply been posing as a trader, passing precious items through the likes of John of Newmarket. His actions alone violated every ordinance in the Liber Albus, the rules of London, yet Hugh Porte and the other sheriffs did nothing. However, when the Crown did intervene and Drockenfold and his colleagues arrived in London, Porte suddenly becomes the hero of the hour. According to the evidence, just after the raid on the Abbey, Porte had apparently learned how a washerwoman in Southwark was holding some of the plunder from the royal treasury, hidden in her house by John of Newmarket. Through that woman, Porte arrested John of Newmarket and interrogated him as to the whereabouts of Richard de Puddlingcott, who was then arrested through his actions, and they got hold. That's where he found him with some of the treasure. Look at Hugh Porte being all up at being a great sheriff and law enforcement agent. However, such a tale becomes all the more remarkable when you look at the proceedings of the royal investigation, what was going on while it was happening. The royal justices had just questioned London's goldsmiths at an extraordinary moment at the Guildhall. The goldsmiths, not yet a guild in the city, but still very powerful men, openly admitted what items they had bought from Puddlingcott and John of Newmarket, in some detail. They explained how they'd bought stolen rings, both complete and broken up ones. They'd bought brooches, rubies, emeralds, precious plates and pearls, or as it seemed, they'd purchased it from Richard the Puddlingcott or John of Newmarket. The goldsmiths of London admitted they'd even sold these items between themselves. But after each detailed account of them handling the treasures of the king, they brazenly added that at the time, they, quote, did not know it was a felony, unquote. Every time, this was stolen? We didn't know, your honours. We acted in good faith. The defence of, we had no idea it was a crime, Governor, must have been extremely difficult for the judges to accept. The names of some of these goldsmiths and those who were standing bail for them are the leading figures in London. They are the principal merchants, the prominent citizens. And their involvement in the purchase of ill-gotten gains from the robbery is way dodgy. According to the evidence delivered at Guildhall, which is based on their own admissions, some 24 transactions took place involving at least a dozen goldsmiths, whilst over 100 different items stolen from the treasury went through their hands. The royal ministers found it hard to take that not one of these goldsmiths had been suspicious of this sudden influx of plate and jewels at a time when such items were rare, mostly due to the ongoing war effort. The excuse given to the judges? Well, the two guys involved, Publincott and John of Newmarket, were not London merchants, and they could have gained this from, you know, elsewhere. The judges were rightfully suspicious of London, and not just at the goldsmiths. What were the city sheriffs doing at this time? But at least one of the sheriffs did arrest the main criminal, right? Well, then, after he's arrested, Pudlingcott is not sent to jail. He's kept in the sheriff's house and then escapes around the 23rd of June. 2 days later, on Tuesday the 25th of June, we read that, quote, a certain individual, Richard the Pudlingcott, was seized violently from the Church of St. Michael in Candlewick Street. He had been captured for the theft of the king's treasure and placed in the custody of Hugh Portie, the then sheriff, and he was seized by Glosselin and Thomas Aidwell, common bailiffs of the city and other unknowns, unquote. Now, there's more to that seizing of him from the church than meets the eye, but for now, this whole situation has clearly put Sheriff Porte in the frame. Why did he not place Pudlingcott in the Tower of London when he arrested him, or even a jail like the Fleet Prison or Newgate? Why did he allow him to stay at his bloody house, and how the hell did the man escape? Hugh Port was under so much suspicion that he needed to swear a solemn oath to say he had nothing to do with the man's escape, and at that a bunch of friends came out of the woodwork to vouchsafe for him, and he actually needed the supporters who would guarantee that he had not been involved in Pudlingcott's escape. Port's actions could be viewed as those of an insolent city official determined to do what he wanted in defiance of royal authority, but his treatment of Pudlingcott during those 5 days makes it look a lot more suspicious. Pudlingcott was incredibly fortunate. He had not been hauled off to some filthy dungeon, but merely placed under house arrest. And from there, he managed to escape and reach the Church of St. Michael's in Candlewick Street. And here's where things start to become even murkier. Candlewick Street was near where two of his accomplices or friends, James LaHorner and Robert Barber, whose sisters were named as part of the robbery, were living. In fact, if you go further, the Candlemaker's Quarter did considerable business with the sacristan of Westminster Abbey, one of the men deeply involved in this robbery. He was responsible for purchasing a huge amount of candles and oil lamps for the Abbey from this district. This seemed to be an ideal place for Pudlingcott to run towards. In fact, when you look at the geography of the city, suddenly this becomes really significant. Pudlingcott had been jailed in Hugh de Porte's house, which stood in the parish of St. Magnus, which was near London Bridge. Once he escaped, our fugitive could have fled across the Thames into Southwark, or east into the wilds of Essex. Of course, he'd be on his own, but he'd be free from London. But he does not do that. He escapes and heads northwest into the heart of the city. I mean, I can understand him avoiding his own house near Dowgate in the river, but it seems to be clear he was hoping to lodge with friends and protectors who would smuggle him out of London. However, he was now a marked man. There seems to be a hue of cry spotted him, and so he failed to reach wherever he was actually seeking to go, so he sought sanctuary in the church along the way. And once inside St. Michael's, Pudlingcott must have actually considered himself safe anyway. He was a clerk, aka he had taken the basics of church ordination, or so he later claimed. And he knew what the rules were when you claim formal sanctuary. See, under the rules, he was free from any secular law enforcement for 40 days. He would be permitted to receive food as well as sufficient liberty to answer the call of nature. Pudlingcott's chances of escape were now incredibly enhanced, and crucially, he was in an area of the city where he had friends and support. If Pudlingcott decided to stay in the sanctuary, he could negotiate with his former jailer, say, Sheriff Hugh Port. Chances are that he would have to abjure the realm, Most criminals who took sanctuary elected to abjure the realm, and Buddlingcote would have to take an oath administered to him by the sheriff, swearing that he would hurry by the most direct route to the nearest port, either one he chooses or one chosen for him. And there he would swear to take the first ship travelling abroad. The abjured felon could not return then without royal permission, and if they dilly-dallied along the way or left the highway, they could be captured and or killed out of hand. But he had the option to do that now. And the truth is, at this exact moment in time, many of the city fathers, particularly the goldsmiths, would have only been too delighted to see the back of Puddlingcote on board some ship heading towards France or the Low Countries. However, it is clear that the Crown was most reluctant to allow sanctuary to the likes of Puddlingcote, not for this crime. At St. Michael's Candlewick, speed became the order of the day, and breaking the rules of sanctuary, a group of men burst in and snatched him and dragged him back into custody. Now, the records I described said the men who did this were Thomas Aitwell and, quote, other common bailiffs in the city, unquote. But that's rubbish. It gives the impression that city officials were responsible. The problem, you see, is that Thomas Aitwell was no common bailiff at all. He was the king's sergeant in the City of London. He carried out the raids to seize Puddlingcote at the behest of the officers of the Crown. The Crown was operating a separate team of men arresting people. They were not allowing London to do this. And Aitwell and the others were probably quietly promised that whatever sanctions the church did impose upon them for breaking sanctuary, he and his companions would be protected. The deed was done and Puddlingcote was captured. And we know someone high up in the city of council was furious at this, because later in August 1303, no less a person than Robert de Winchelsey, the Archbishop of Canterbury himself, ordered Aitwell and his companions to do a large physical penance for that raid. But it didn't matter to this case. The Crown had its man and Puddlingcote was removed to the Tower. So was the Sheriff of London in on the robbery? Well, Sheriff Portier of London comes across as a shadowy and sinister figure suddenly. He was a loan shark doing brisk business during this period, and he also mixed with London's old underworld. I mean, that's not exceptional. Medieval sheriffs are not noted for their public piety or personal integrity. We know that in a few years' time, this sheriff would be named as leading an attack on a royal manor belonging to the king's daughter Elizabeth and her husband the Earl of Hereford. Port's name is the first of the list of those given mentioning on that attack, which denotes that he was a leader. What's interesting about the incident is, in connection to this robbery story, is that Port's second in command in that assault was a man called Richard de Keumpies, also a former sheriff of London, and the name Keumpies surfaces in one piece of evidence in this robbery. In the list of prisoners placed in the Tower of London at the end of the royal investigation during the summer of 1303 are the names of the six pages of the sacristan Adam de Warfield. One of these six is called John de Keumpies. He's placed squarely amongst the guilty members of Warfield's gang imprisoned in the Tower. Yet, apart from that one mention, that's the last we hear of him in all this matter. He simply seems to disappear, as if someone or someone's plucked this man out of the trouble going on. Hugh Porter comes to mind at once. London protects its own. Suspicions deeper over Porter over his appointment as sheriff in April 1302. Hugh Porter was reluctant to become sheriff. He actually refused to accept the task twice and had to be forced into it with fines and everything. So here is Hugh de Port, whose behaviour is suspicious during the time of the robbery, being most reluctant to become sheriff at the exact time Puddlingcote and his gang were planning to raid the Abbey Refectory and in the following spring the Royal Treasury. On the balance of probabilities, there was a connection between Puddlingcote and some of the city fathers, who secretly supported and looked the other way when the robbery took place. And that Puddlingcote was given protection through Hugh Porter, who, taken by surprise by the royal ministers in summer, had no choice but to change roles, organise Puddlingcote's swift arrest, and depict himself as a hero of the hour. But even then, Porter did his best for Puddlingcote, and if he had not been for the swift actions of royal officials, he almost succeeded in getting Puddlingcote out of England. King Edward and the royal investigators must have totally suspected the involvement of London's city fathers, but establishing evidence was another matter. Had they done so, the Crown would have definitely considered taking over London again and in the office of mayor for a second time. The city fathers, however, closed ranks. The goldsmiths in the main were not knowing they'd committed any crime. Porter was cast into the role of a vigilant royal official. The robbery was the work of certain monks and their confederates from London's underworld. And because he lacked firm proof, the king would have to concede this. The cover-up had worked. So what was the outcome? Well, on Thursday, the 5th of March, 1304, the judges delivered their judgment on one group of robbers. William of the Palace and four others were sentenced to be dragged through the city and hanged at the Elms of Smithfield. We do not know who the others were, but given the number of indictments, William of the Palace must have been joined at the scaffold by John de Lenton, John de Rippenhale, John of St. Albans, and John of Newmarket. Sentence was carried out immediately. The chaplain of the Tower of London must have performed the last ceremonies on the condemned men, who would have been stripped apart from their tunics, tied to hurdles, lashed to horses, and accompanied by guards and grotesque figures wearing masks and singing songs of mockery. They were dragged through the mud and dirt of the city, along Cheapside, past Newgate, and out, as the chronicles put it, quote, to the Elms, unquote. That sinister clump of trees near the Priory of St. Bartholomew at Smithfield, where executions were to be carried out until the beginning of the reign of Edward III. We do not know what happened to the rest of the gang. One source says, quote, many were captured and hanged, unquote. But there is no evidence of this in other chronicles or documents of the time, yet I would be surprised if they survived with their lives. Yet the fate of Richard the Pudlingcut and the monks was a totally separate matter. All the records talk of 10 monks. These were the usual suspects listed by the different juries of London and elsewhere. The 10 monks who were behind it all: Alexander de Pershore, Ralph de Morton, Alexander of Newport, John the Notary, William de Clark, Thomas of Lichfield, Roger de Bruis, John de Buttery, Thomas the Dean, and of course, Adam de Warfield. These had been kept separate from the other criminals, and understandably, but surprisingly, they were joined by Richard de Pudlingcut, who now, cool as a cucumber, declared that he was a clerk and so could not be tried by secular court. 10 monks of Westminster and one clerk, because of said robbery, were now led into the presence of the justices and accused of being behind it all. And they replied, saying, quote, that in no way did they wish to withdraw from the liberty that is the privilege of the church, nor would they, without the advice of their ordinaries, submit themselves to secular judges. Hearing this, the said judges moved to solemn inquisition. The inquiry condemned the sacristan of Westminster for receiving and concealing jewels of the Lord King, and the said 10 monks were sent to the Tower until the king's pleasure was known, unquote. Yep, the monks played their ace card. They were monks. They were not subject to secular judges, not even those working directly for the king. I mean, this move was an obvious one. And it's simply a measure how goddamn furious the king had been that they found themselves having to wait so long before they could do it. And ultimately, the king could not undermine the authority of the church, as the lesson of the martyr Thomas Becket still hung over the crown. Technically, according to the law, the trial should have ended there and then, but the justices' fury at the obvious guilt of these monks and their anger at their arrogance is obvious. You get the sense after all of this, the only defence this bunch of monks could use was, hey, you know you can't touch us, right? You can almost feel Drockensfold and the royal justices basically saying, you utter bastards, in the fact that even if they could not punish him, they publicly condemned Adam de Warfield as the person who'd received and concealed stolen goods. And justices were on safe ground doing that. They were not challenging his status, nor any of the monks. They were simply recording his dishonesty. However, Richard the Pudlingcut was a different matter. He may have been an itinerant merchant, a married man, but that did not preclude the fact that he may have been a clerk, that is, someone who received minor orders but had not progressed forward to ordination as a priest, and that would place them under church law. But this was an exceptional case. The judges wanted Pudlingcut, but they had to be careful. Already there'd been an issue. Pudlingcut had been snatched from sanctuary already, and that was a big no-no. But to add some pressure to the moment, the monks were detained at the royal pleasure whilst the crown officials investigated Pudlinkut's claim to be a clerk. While there exists no official ruling, it is clear that Pudlinkut was disqualified as a clerk and as such no longer immune to secular law. And we know this, as in the end, Pudlinkut was executed. On the 28th of November 1305, this story comes to a close. It was a Sunday, a day of rest, a day chosen particularly because the crowds would be out and busy, especially around Westminster Abbey. Pudlinkut is still called a clerk, but he's not dragged through the city. He is ridiculed, placed in nothing better than a wheelbarrow, and pushed through the city along the riverbank into Westminster itself. We know that Pudlinkut was hanged, but Edward was determined to make a statement about this man who had robbed his treasury. On the door leading to the chapter house at Westminster, beneath the hinges, is what antiquarians described as human skin. There is every possibility that once he had been hanged, Pudlinkut's body was not gibbeted, but skinned, and the skin was dried, cured, and hung on the door in the south cloister of Westminster Abbey as a warning to the monks from the king. Indeed, there is some speculation that King Edward may have had the corpses of all the robbers skinned and nailed to a door as a warning to the monks. And so today we tell the story of a robbery by four men who were hung for their crime, and wise historians actually say it was the monks of the abbey who did this, and these men were made scapegoats. But what is obvious here and now is that something else was going on around this robbery. The robbery of the king, while dreamt up by a bunch of bent monks in Westminster Abbey and facilitated by a bunch of criminals who flocked together to do this Westminster job, was known of and sympathised by high-ranking officials in the City of London. But what really condemns the city was that knowledge of this crime, well, it wasn't limited to just high-ranking Londoners. Because everyone knew who did this crime. Everybody in London seemed to know what had happened and who was responsible. One thing that stands out is that during the investigations, the royal commissioners summoned what were in effect grand juries from every single ward of London to gather up information from the residents of the entire city in Southwark and Westminster and more. They just wanted to know, what did Londoners know about this robbery? And it turns out they knew everything. The names, the details, the brains behind it. The story I just told emerges from their testimony. The main form of entertainment in the 14th century was obviously what's going on outside your doors. London's gossip was as powerful then as today's internet. And from the testimony of the juries, we know that everybody knew what was happening. Everybody knew who was responsible. Everybody knew such and such was buying stolen goods of such and such that were stolen from there. It's just that nobody told the authorities a damn thing. Nobody said a damn word. We have this image of the Cray twins and that archetype of Londoners sticking up for them. You know, a certain pride in the acts of criminals who are like diamond geezers. Everyone knows who they are, but no one says nothing. This image in our heads and in the media is stuck forever in the double-breasted suits of the late 1950s and early 60s. But in truth, the first manifestation of this is found here, in 1303, with attitudes towards the large gang of criminals who pulled off what was the greatest theft in medieval history. Because, you see, that's the most overlooked part of this Westminster job. They did it. They fully succeeded. They conceived, planned, organised and carried out a daring three-day heist of the most secure vault in England. They robbed the crown jewels of England and then some. I mean, there were a few mistakes, but ultimately, they did it. The robbery was not formally detected. And then they started the difficult process of selling on the stolen goods. And over 6 weeks, they had scattered and spread out the treasure. If they had had just another month, the chances are they would have gotten away with it. Some would have left London, probably to Europe, Some would have now made a new life. Others, such as the monks, would have sat back happy and safe. Idiots like William of the Palace would have no doubt talked himself into being captured, but by the time that happened, the goods would have been long gone and his confession would have been worthless. It was just the speed of the king and his agents which unravelled as brilliant and daring robbery. The Westminster job speaks of timeless elements of London's past that remain even to this day. Everybody knows snitches get stitches. That's why I adore this story so. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. Oof, it's quite a lot in there. So this episode and the last mostly got the information from a brilliant book about this that goes into way more detail. And if you want to really get into this great robbery, I heartily recommend it. It's written by an excellent historian called Doherty, and it's called The Great Crown Jewels Robbery of 1303, The Extraordinary Story of the First Big Bank Raid in History. I think it's marvellous and really does drag you into the heart and depth of London during this era. I'll be back next week with another episode of The Story of London, and honestly, we will finally get around to the execution of William Wallace and his friends, as well as other things, as we move towards the last few years of the life of Edward I. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.